The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 214.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hello, everyone. I hope you are well. Welcome to today's live stream. It is Sunday afternoon. I am here in the temporary office, Phoenix, Arizona. Believe it or not, this is going to be the last live stream, the last Sunday live stream I do from this office. Next week, it's going to be in the next couple weeks, probably be for an Airbnb. And then after that, probably Puerto Rico for a couple months, but you guys will see the new surroundings. Not much will change as far as the content. In fact, nothing will change as far as the content, maybe just the scenery. Okay, if you guys haven't checked out the new Rebel Capitalist YouTube channel, check it out. It's me doing the news 2 to 3 times per day, usually live streams, just like this, where I get done going over the news story and giving you my feedback on it. I answer a couple questions, do some shout outs, quick, maybe 10, 20 minutes, and that's 2 to 3 times a day. So you guys would love it. If you haven't checked it out, definitely go to YouTube and just type in Rebel Capitalist and the channel should pop up. Let's get into your questions. Let me go to the top. All right, where do we start? To get to a period of hyperinflation, we have to suffer through 1970s type of inflation. Yeah, but it might not be suffering. It might be 1970s type of inflation while we have an economic boom. Let me keep going here. What do you feel is the probability of reaching the 1970s style inflation in the next 3 years? Well, if you're basing that on the video I did Friday, to get up to 1970s style inflation, which the CPI was, the government CPI was around 12, let's say. Now, since the numbers are cooked, we'd need to get up to maybe 8%. So what are the chances the CPI goes from 1.7% up to 8% in the next 3 years? I would say 40. I'd say 40%. If I had to just kind of guess. And then keep in mind, there's a 10% chance we would get deflation. 20% chance maybe we get deflation. Maybe even 30. I don't know. As far as asset price deflation, not consumer price inflation. But as far as asset price deflation, so 30% maybe asset price deflation, 40% 1970s type of stagflation, CPI getting up to 8. Keep in mind though, even if we have asset deflation, I think you've still got CPI at 1.5, something like that. It might dip down below 1 for a year, but then I think it goes right back up. That's the lowest I think you'll see consumer prices go. If you are you comfortable selecting Interactive Brokers, the option to let them borrow your stocks? I mean, here's what I can say on that topic. Every single pro that I know, even the pros in Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh that I work with in Rebel Capitalist Pro and the online investment forum we have, they all use IB, Interactive Brokers, because it gives you so many more options in terms of buying foreign stocks. That's what the pros use, so that's what I use. I think, and a lot of those pros that I'm talking about are very cognizant of counterparty risk, which I'm sure is what you're getting at. So if they're okay with the counterparty risk, I think I'd be okay with it. Have I heard Fannie and Freddie are discussing discontinue investor loans on 1 to 4 units? If so, what do you think this will do to the prices as non-Fannie money at 6%? I don't know if that would have a huge impact.
I'd be surprised if they discontinued on 1 to 4 units. 1 to 4 units. So anything other than single family, maybe that's what you're implying. I don't know if that makes a huge dent. I mean, it's definitely a headwind, but it's so much of a supply issue right now, even more so than demand, as crazy as that sounds. Non-Fannie money quoted in the 6%. Yeah, I don't know that that makes a huge impact on the market. Definitely a headwind, though, and definitely something we should be cognizant of for sure. And keep in mind, even if it does, real estate is a slow-moving vehicle. In other words, for us, for real estate prices start to turn and go the other direction to any significant degree, it takes like years. It just doesn't happen overnight. Why is it the Fed funds rate predicted to go up, but SOFR rate appears to be going down? Please explain the difference and what it means to the average consumer. Well, I mean, there's not really, you don't want to really compare Fed funds with SOFR. I think you want to compare LIBOR with SOFR. I mean, SOFR is kind of a rate that's based on transactions that are actually occurring in repo, and as opposed to basically a questionnaire that the banks have on. They say, what would you lend to XYZ Bank today? What rate? And that's LIBOR. It's just basically a questionnaire that they answer. It's not real actual transactions. SOFR is. As far as SOFR, see, Fed funds. I mean, basically, if SOFR is going down, see, that has a lot. They're different contributing factors. Because Fed funds is basically IOER, which is interest on excess reserves. That's the Fed kind of pegs that rate unless repo spikes like it did back in September 2019. Potentially, Fed funds can get above the Federal Reserve's target level. That's tough for it to happen. Basically, if SOFR is doing that, they're kind of calling the Fed's bluff. The reason why there's talk of Fed increasing IOER, two reasons. Number one, to keep the long end of the curve down, but I highly doubt they're going to do that. Or if short-term rates go negative because Janet Yellen dumping the bank reserves from the TGA into the commercial banking system, potentially taking the short end of the curve negative, the Fed might have to increase Fed funds. But I don't think they've talked about increasing Fed funds from their target of 0 to 25 basis points up past the 25 basis point mark. I think they just talked about, or the markets talked about, some bank analysts have talked about them moving it from like 10 basis points to 15 basis points to try to get the short end of the curve up over zero if it does go negative. Now, to what degree that will work, who knows? 5 basis point move? I don't know. As far as them just throwing in the towel and saying, okay, we need to go above 25 basis points, that would be pretty surprising, but who knows? Maybe they'll have to. But the bottom line is, I don't know that SOFR is going down because Fed funds is predicted to go up. I think those are two separate things that are happening. But, if SOFR is going down, that could be because there's so much pressure on the short end of the yield curve as far as rates. That could bring SOFR down. Another thing you have to remember is that SOFR is a weird interest rate, because on the surface, it seems like that should be a good idea because it's based on actual transactions. But in reality, it's kind of misleading, because as is the repo rate, because it's one rate that's an average total of, like, let's say 1,000 transactions that range anywhere between, I mean, they can range wildly between, let's say, 5% and like even like negative 10 basis points in one day, but the it might average out to like 15 basis points. So repo for that day is 15 basis points. But what you don't see, it's like looking at a golf score and, you know, par is 72 and someone comes in and they shot a 72. But what you don't realize is they had an eagle, double bogeys, birdies, triple bogey. They didn't have 18 straight pars, and the repo rate's the same. So, you know, they're saying, yeah, SOFR's great because it's based on repo transactions. Well, yeah, but average, I mean, they could be all over the place. So anyway, I don't want to get off on a tangent, but I think we've gone far enough down that rabbit hole. Good question. Have you had to raise outside capital for investments, or has your success been built on incremental with a closer, more personal team? I've never had to raise outside capital. No. When I started the first kind of big business was back in 2006 or so. Around 2006, the end of 2006. I had my own money saved up, about $100,000 that I put into it, and I needed $500. So I had to go borrow $400. So that would have been outside money, but it's not like I had to go raise capital. A buddy of mine knew me well, a guy that I had done some consulting for. I actually just sold a business for him. And he basically asked me, he said, "Hey, what are you doing next? Like, what's your next move?" And I said, "Well, I'm probably going to start this new business, XYZ. He's like, "Okay, do you need money?" I'm like, he said, "Yeah." Or I said, "Yeah, I need $400. And he says, "Okay, well, let's do it. Here are my terms." And I looked at the terms and I looked up and said, "Okay, let's do it." And the terms were completely outrageous. Looking back in retrospect, but I had a lot of confidence in my ability, probably too much, but it all worked out in the end. But my point is, as far as raising outside capital from people I don't know, or that didn't know me well, or that I hadn't worked for, done consulting for in the past, I've never done that. What are your favorite equity and non-equity way to go long vol? Well, non-equity would be options. I mean, I guess that could be considered equity if you're using options on specific stocks. But I think you're more talking about just buying a stock out, like going long or short a stock. So options would be non-equity. Equity, man, that's a tough question. I don't know if there's a way to go long vol. Like, I mean, see, here's the problem. Is that vol is not necessarily the stock market going down. It's the stock market going up as well. It's volatility is doesn't necessarily have to be to the downside. That's what, you know, people call it, you know, left and right tail risk. And it's a tail risk, but the tail risk can be to the upside just as much as the downside. So I'd have to think through what. Like okay, so let's think through like upside tail risk with volatility. Right now, I think that's with the TGA. So Janet Yellen has $1 trillion or so that she wants to spend, at least she said this, she wants to spend from the TGA into the market. So $250 billion call it for the next 4 months. Well, that's QE. That's adding bank reserves to the system. So if you're someone that believes QE has the tendency to push up asset prices, then you've got to believe that asset prices will go up or have a high probability of going up, risk assets, so equities, over the next 4 months. If Janet Yellen does this, I mean, I'm guessing that she's going to maybe do it and it's going to affect the short end of the curve. And all these bankers that actually know what's going on are going to call her and say, "Stop! You don't know what you're doing. Just stop! Stop spending $250 trillion a month. You're doing $250 trillion in QE." And I think maybe she wants to, but I don't know that she realizes how that could potentially affect the T-bills, pristine collateral, short end of the yield curve on the Treasury. But the Treasury curve. So if she does it, and let's say she does it and it doesn't push those rates negative to where she gets kind of a get out of jail free card, well then, whew, man, I could see the equity markets just rip higher. Again, you got to think the Fed's doing 120 worth of QE right now per month. And that's, you could say that that's one of the main reasons the stock market has gone to where it is today from the lows in March 2020. And if you believe that, then, I mean, again, what happens if Janet Yellen does an extra 250 on top of the 120 that's already being done? That's 370 billion dollars per month of QE. So that's when I think you could just get this rip higher in the market. So then my point is you got to ask yourself, in that environment, what happens to the yield curve? What happens to, do we still see a rotation from growth to value? Maybe, I don't know. You'd have to think through all those scenarios and then say, okay, I'm going to position myself this way on the going long to take advantage of this tail risk that no one's really thinking about to the upside with vol, where the market goes up by, who knows, 30% in the next 4 months. And then you'd have to think if it's a result of Janet Yellen doing this additional QE, what stocks are going to benefit from that? And then position yourself. And then you'd have to think, okay, if the QE taps stop or if the stimulus stops, that's most likely going to bring on some deflation in asset prices, especially in the stock market. Or if the long end of the curve continues to go up and the Fed doesn't do anything about it, that could have some tail risk there on the downside with vol in certain stocks. And then you position yourself accordingly based on that. You see, so that's not just a real short, easy answer. There's a lot to think through. And I would just maybe try to lay it out on a spreadsheet and then determine the probabilities of each and then try to build like a mini portfolio around that. But if you're going to go long vol, make sure that you're setting up the rest of the Dragon portfolio as well, and that you've got some gold. You remember, you got to have some bonds. I mean, that's scary, but you still got to do it right now if you want to implement the Dragon portfolio. And then you've got to have some long exposure, just straight long exposure to equities. And then you've got to do commodity trend. Have I started a presidential run? No, those rumors are not true. No, not true at all. In your 10-80-10 portfolio, what's your favorite cash flowing asset that doesn't include real estate investments? Yeah, so just commodity producing stocks. I bought a ton of them back in March of 2020. And this paying great, well, some of the dividends got reduced, but some of those offshore commodity producers paying solid dividends, that would definitely be my favorite other than real estate. Where's your line in the sand that has to be crossed in order for you to leave the country? Well, that line in the sand was crossed a long time ago because I don't spend too much time in the United States, and I'm only going to be spending maybe another, I don't know, maybe another month. So I don't now, as far as what line in the sand would have to be crossed in order for me to like renounce my citizenship or something, that's a different question. I don't know. It depends on my family situation at the time. Assuming I had a passport set up that had visa-free travel to the United States, so I could just come back whenever I want for 3 months at a time, which is usually how much time I spend in the U.S. now. So that wouldn't be a big transition. That wouldn't be a big shift for me. But yeah, that's a big step when you renounce your citizenship. That's a big deal. So I think probably a wealth tax. If they implemented a federal wealth tax, that's so antithetical to the Constitution, and it's not constitutional, is what I'm saying. And if they cross that line, just did something, you know, that would be, we have officially gone from being a country of law to a country of men at that point. If we're just pushing things through that just because it's popular, and, you know, the Constitution will just forget about it, or it's a breathing document, which they always say, which is nonsense. We just find a way around it, something like that. But that's probably the line in the sand for me.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Question, I have a 401k 200 on 46. What you meant, see, would you recommend pulling it out now to buy real estate and eat the penalty, or keep it in? Well, I mean, it's not like real estate's cheap right now. I mean, real estate's in a bubble. I'm not saying don't buy it, but you got to know what you're doing, because you'd have to buy it with 30-year fixed rate debt, or you'd have to be in a certain situation in your life where you just didn't really care about an equity drawdown of 30 or 40% because you're never going to sell. I mean, if that's your position, then there could be some, you know, there could be some factors at play to where I'd say, oh no, maybe you want to go ahead and buy here. But just looking at it as far as on a spreadsheet right now in numbers, unless you're using 30-year fixed rate debt, I don't know. I'd think twice. And then as far as 401k eating it, I mean, I think a better question would be, do I just eat the penalty and take the money out of the 401k just to invest the money myself wherever I wanted to? I mean, can't you do a self-directed 401k? I don't know anything about 401ks. I mean, absolutely nothing. But I've never had one. Don't know anything about that. Don't know anything about an IRA. But maybe a self-directed, well, I guess it's a self-directed IRA, isn't it? Yeah, so forget it. Heather, if it were me, I'd take it out and just eat the penalty, because I'm unique in the sense that I really, 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 I don't sleep well if other people are in control of my money. I don't sleep well at all. Maybe you're someone who sleeps better if other people are in control of your money. So it's not an apples to apples comparison, because my personality is so unique, I think. Sometimes that's good, sometimes it's bad. But I don't like it to be in a fund. I don't like it to be part of this. I don't like to have my options limited. I mean, I hate that. It's one of the reasons why I move around so much, and why I'm kind of a minimalist to a certain degree, because I hate being tied down to, like, okay, here's your investments. You can invest in these three things. Which do you choose? And if you want to invest in something else, oh, tough. You can't do that because you got it in a 401k. I would rather make less money and just have the option of investing in anything I wanted to than kind of be pigeonholed into one thing and feel like I'm constrained. It makes me just, I don't sleep well at night that way. And that's just a weird quirk to my personality. Okay, next question. George, would there be any rule change that the banks can do to avoid imminent crash or reset? I don't think they need to. The banks are pretty well capitalized right now. I mean, the banks don't have that many issues. It's not a big, the biggest issue the banks have is the yield curve, in my opinion. So if the Fed pegs the yield curve and does yield curve control, that's the biggest issue that the banks have. But as far as them just collapsing like they did in 2008, I don't know if there's that much of a risk. There's still a risk, of course, but I don't know if the risk is as high as it was back in, call it 2007, 2008. There's far more liquidity. I mean, my goodness gracious, you got to think about it. I mean, just look at the excess reserves in the system, right? Or the reserves period. I mean, back prior to the GFC, the excess reserves in the system were just like the TGA. I mean, it was nothing, just nothing. And now look at it. I mean, the Fed's expanded its balance sheet up over $7 trillion. So those are bank reserves that are assets of the commercial banking system. That's pure liquidity. So they don't have that. Those, now I'm not saying they don't have issues, but they don't have the same type of issues. So my point is, I don't know that they really need a rule change. I don't think the crash in the banking system is imminent. I think we have other dangers that could create a crash or a reset, but I don't know if it's the American. Now, if your question is regarding Europe or Australia or Canada, that's a different question. I'm assuming that this is an American-centric question and you're asking about the American banks. And keep in mind too, most of their debt or any toxic garbage on their balance sheet, the Fed can just buy it. Just give them 100 cents on the dollar. I mean, back prior to the GFC, that would have been unthinkable because the Fed had never done it. But I mean, considering what they've done from 2008 to 2020, and then considering what they did in 2020, and my goodness gracious, should we think for one second if any bank had an issue, the Fed wouldn't just step right in and buy any toxic asset they had on their balance sheet for 100 cents on the dollar? I mean, that's, in my opinion, that's what would happen. Very high probability. Have you seen Maloney's gold chart, which is going to 11,000 for an ounce in November 2020? What I think about it? Yeah, very possibly. But you got to keep in mind that just because it goes to 11,000 doesn't mean that you're increasing your purchasing power. If gold goes to 11,000 an ounce and it just goes up with the rate of inflation, so that means over the next 2 years, the prices of goods and services, let's say, doubles, goes up by, or maybe more. You know, I guess it would have to go up more than that for gold to be at 11,000 in nominal terms. But if it just goes up in nominal terms, even if it doesn't maintain the rate of inflation, in order to spend in order to turn the gold into dollars to buy something with it, you gotta sell it. And if you sell it, you got a huge capital gain tax to pay. So, I mean, I don't know what your cost basis is, Zelena, but let's just say it's $1,000 and it goes up to 11,000. Great. Now you got a $10,000 capital gain you got to pay. And who knows what cap gains taxes are in 2023. Let's say it goes up to income. So now all of a sudden you've got a 40% capital gains tax on $10,000. So that's, let's say, $4,000 you have to pay in taxes. 11,000, that takes you down to 7,000. So now all of a sudden you've lost a ton of purchasing power relative to the price of goods and services, even though your gold went from, let's say now where it is, call it 1,800 up to 11,000. You see, now that said, we could get 1970s type inflation and over the next couple of years, in which case that would be a huge gain in real terms. That's possible. But then remember, you've got the taxes. I don't know, for some reason, a lot of Americans think that they don't have a capital gains tax because they're selling gold coins or something like that. And it's actual money. So the United States government doesn't tax that. That's incorrect. That kind of gets perpetuated a lot in the gold world, maybe by people trying to sell gold. I don't know. But that is true in some places. I believe in the UK, that's true. But for American citizens, everything I've read and every pro that I've talked to says that is not true. Gold is considered like a taxable, just like selling oil or something like that, like a commodity type thing. Even if it's a gold coin, What are your thoughts on the theory the Japanese carry trade is underway, which would put downward pressure on treasury rates and upward pressure on the dollar? I don't know. I mean, I think they were talking about this on CNBC the other day. I forgot the guy's name. That's a famous guy that was talking about this. I just don't know you're going to, I mean, okay, so you borrow in yen, you buy in dollars, but then you've got the currency risk. To hedge out your currency risk is going to cost you probably the spread in the basis points between the Japanese 10-year and call it the 10-year treasury. Maybe at a certain point that comes into play, but then you've got, you also have that risk of interest rates going up, and then you're locked into holding that for however long it is till maturity. And who knows what happens to inflation during that time frame. I guess it wouldn't matter if your expenses are denominated in yen, you've got that hedged out. But I think the higher the delta there, the more costly the hedge would be. So I'm by no means a trader, and I'm not a currency trader or anything like that. So this is just kind of some just right off the top of my head things. I see. If you got to put yourself in the Japanese investor, so they can borrow low. Okay, I get it. But they borrow, they come over here, and you're just expecting them to capture the delta, but then they've got currency risk. I mean, I think maybe the question would be this, Brendan. Would you borrow in dollars to buy Colombian denominated debt or Russian denominated debt or Mexican denominated debt? And if not, why? And what if you could hedge it the same way? You'd probably be like, I don't know, man. Who knows what's going to happen to the, you know, the dollar goes up against, and all my expenses are in dollars. So I could lose a lot of purchasing power if the peso were to go down in dollars because I'm being paid on that asset in pesos or rubles, something like that. But the Japanese investor would have the exact same dilemma. And then even if you could hedge, keep in mind that if that peso bond that you buy at a 5% yield, because you can borrow at a 2% interest rate in dollars, if that yield goes from 5% up to 7%, well, now you're screwed. You can't sell, because if you sell, you're going to take a massive capital loss. Because if the interest rate goes from 5 to 7, what does the value of your bond do? It tanks. It gets crushed. So now all of a sudden, you're backed up into a corner where you have to keep that to maturity. And let's say the maturity on that's 5 or 10 years. You really want to hold on to pesos if your expenses are denominated in dollars for the next 10 years, even if you've got a decent way to hedge it? What's the cost of hedging going to be in 5 years? Who knows? Maybe that cost to hedge your peso exposure could be far more than you're making. So there's got to be an additional risk premium there. And I mean, maybe on the margin, but I don't know if it's enough to move the market. I think maybe something that would move rates lower would be the Fed just coming in and buying the hell out of the long end of the curve. I don't know if the market itself is going to be driving down interest rates. You got to keep in mind too, remember the Fed is doing 100 or not 120 of QE with treasuries, but they're doing 80, I think 80 and 40. So 80 with treasuries, 40 of mortgage-backed securities. And think about this, the long end of the curve, let's say, or at least the 10-year, has gone from 50 basis points up to 150 basis points. So it's gone up by, you know, it's gone straight up by 100 basis points, while at the same time, the Fed is buying $80 billion of those 10-year, 30-year treasuries every single month. So what does that tell you about the private sector demand coming in from Japan or the United States public? It's goose egg. That's basically what it's telling you. Because if the Fed wasn't out there buying $80 billion per month, and they're not buying the short end of the curve, you can tell by, because you can go to the Fed's balance sheet and see how many T-bills they have, how many treasuries they have total, how many T-bills, how many notes, and how many bonds. And they only have like $300 billion in T-bills. Now, I don't know what percentage between notes and bonds, but, and keep my notes 10-year, bonds 30-year. I don't know what they have under 10-year, but they, with the T-bills, which would be from zero to a year, they only have $300 billion. So they're not buying the short end of the curve. That's the last thing they want to do, because that puts downward pressure on interest rates, and they're already close to negative. They're getting way, way too close to zero. So they're already buying the long end of the curve. So my point is, if the Fed wasn't there buying the long end, where would the 10-year be? I was listening to Gundlach the other day, and based on his models, he was saying that the 10-year would be between 2.5 and 3% right now if the Fed wasn't in there buying. There's just no demand. So, I mean, I think it's an interesting thought experiment, but I don't know that I would, I definitely would not make an investment right now or a trade based on this happening to the extent that it would really move the market. What are my favorite resources of information? Google. That's it, Peter. Pretty much, well, not pretty much. I would say 99% of everything that you guys see in a whiteboard video is just me Googling. And just, I mean, if I could do a screen share right now and you guys could see what I'm seeing my browser. I mean, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm not going to count all of them, but I've got at least probably 30 tabs open on my Chrome browser, because it's all stuff that I'm thinking through for whiteboard videos, like just in some stuff I've been trying to think through for a couple weeks. And I just keep them up here organized in sections based on topic, so I can go back and reference them. But it's all just from Google. I don't have like a Bloomberg terminal or anything like that. Nothing fancy. I don't have anything that you guys don't have. Just right there on your phone or your laptop. What are your thoughts on TLT long-term bonds? I mean, it's not really the way I think through things. I mean, as far as would I make a financial decision based on my view? No. As far as a thought experiment, where would I be? I mean, do we have a free market or do we have the Fed? If we have a free market, I'm bearish. As far as, in other words, I think rates would go up. So I'm bearish on the price of the bonds. If, but once they get to a certain point, I think what's going to happen, I agree with Lynn. I've been listening to Lynn, and she's been going back and forth in Rebel Capitalist Pro. I think she got this question the other day. And basically her view is the Fed's going to do nothing because they're just a reactionary vehicle until something breaks. So they're going to let the long end go up and just do nothing. And once something breaks, then they'll step in, and probably with the government, the fiscal side as well. So I think the Fed put is kind of done, quite frankly. I think now we've just gone into a government put. So it's not, you know, the way Lynn says it is, she's like, we've moved from monetary to fiscal. And the way I say it, we've just gone from a Fed put to a government put. But you're saying the exact same thing. And that's that the government is going to have to be a lot more involved if we get another collapse in the stock market, or in, I don't think we could get a collapse in the housing market. But if you start to see month over month over month, the housing market is having problems, or the economy is really having problems, unemployment starts skyrocketing a lot higher than it already is based on the government's measurements, then it's all about fiscal. So, you know, my point is once something breaks, then they're going to come in and peg it, most likely. But at what point does it break? I don't know. I mean, last time it broke at what, 3%? I'd have to look back in 2018 when the market just tanked and what the 10-year got up to when they were doing QT. I don't know if it got up to 2.5, 3%. And then I'd probably subtract 50 basis points because the system is so much more fragile now than it was in 2018. And the market is even more addicted to the monetary heroin. Therefore, you need more of the stimulus before the effects start to wear off. So let's just say that it was at 3%. I'd say now I'd be at 2.5. If it's at 2.5 before, I'd say now it's probably around 2, that zone where we're going to get a big problem. But there's so many cross currents, who knows? That's just me kind of throwing out a guess, really.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Do you think yield curve control and Operation Twist will affect prices on the miners? So yield curve control would. Operation Twist. Here's why I hesitate with that, Matt. It's a great question because we've got to think through what the biggest driver of gold is right now, and it's most likely real interest rates. So even if real rates are negative, if they're continuing to go less negative, just real rates increasing, that's a real headwind for precious metals, especially gold. So if rates can get more negative, though, go down in real terms, when you adjust for inflation, then that's going to be a big tailwind. So what type of environment would we have to have? There's two things that can happen. Number one, rates have to go down or the CPI print has to surprise to the upside. So how could rates go down? If the Fed comes in and pegs the long end of the curve, and that's not something the market's expecting, they're off sides. Therefore, the future expectation for real rates increasing goes to zero, if not the market completely does a 180 and now expects real rates to go down further, even further negative. And that's where you get a huge, most likely, you get a huge pop in gold. Therefore, the gold miners. So yeah, if they're doing yield curve control, I definitely think there's a lot of tailwind there for the price. So then you could have a double whammy if you start to get higher CPI prints while at the same time they're capping rates. Because then the market assumes that not only are real rates not going up, but now they're going down. I made that clear. And then as far as, Operation Twist. So my concern with Operation Twist is they've only got $300 billion to twist. it's not limitless. To do Operation Twist, you're buying the long end, but you're selling the short end. So the whole point of Operation Twist is so your bank reserve neutral. What I mean by that is the bank reserves and the commercial that are circulating within the commercial banking system, you don't increase or decrease them because you are you are selling just as many assets as you are buying. So when you're selling those assets, then you're decreasing the amount of bank reserves. When you're buying assets, you're increasing the amount of bank reserves. So they've only got $300 billion to twist with. And I don't think that would, especially when they're doing $120 billion a month right now, I don't know that that's would really move the needle enough to keep those long rates down for an extended period of time, at least not enough time to give gold a big bull run of, like, you know, 6 months, a year, something like that. So that's kind of my thoughts on it. We saw a house, 5,500 square feet, selling for $900K. 2 years ago, the house was $750. Is it worth it to buy it now or wait? Well, I don't know. I don't have enough information to answer the question. I'm going to have to punt on that one. But I can say that if you do buy it, I'd suggest buying it with 30-year fixed rate debt. I would try to look at a chart of the Dallas area, adjusted for inflation, going back as far as I could. I'd try to look at the RV ratios to see how close to a 1% RV ratio you're getting, which is, so a 1% RV ratio on that house would mean that you can rent it for $9,000 a month, because a 1% is going to be your monthly gross rent relative to your cost basis. Okay. So my guess is you probably can't rent that house for $9,000 a month. My guess is you're probably renting that house for, what, $4,500 maybe, let's say, which would give you a 0.5 RV ratio, which would translate into it being expensive. A couple metrics, it might be kind of cheap. If you look at a construction, I mean, you're looking at, what, 180 a square foot. I'm just really ballparking this. Maybe 180 a square foot. So your build in Dallas is probably going to be 220 a square foot. So that would make it cheap by that metric, meaning you're probably buying for under the cost of construction. But it's you're going to have to do the numbers on your own, Rose. And then I don't know what your situation is. I don't know if you've got there's so many different variables, but that's just me thinking out loud. And those are the first metrics that I would look at when I was trying to make a decision. Do I like any other cities in Colombia besides Medellin? Well, I mean, it depends on if you're talking about just the real estate market or just for living. If you're talking about the real estate market, yeah, Bogota could be interesting. I mean, that's the capital city. I mean, Cartagena could be interesting. I think Santa Marta, if you're wanting to do like Airbnb. As far as Cali's cheap. Cali's cheaper than Medellin as far as a price per square meter. So if you wanted to really get, you know, try to buy it at bargain basement prices, if you're bullish on the country, might want to look at Cali. But as far as living, I don't think any place can touch Medellin. Bogota, the weather's kind of cold. I don't really like that. If I had to live somewhere else in Colombia, it'd probably be, I don't know. I don't know if I'd spend, Medellin's my favorite by far. Yeah, that's going to be my final answer. I wish I could be more decisive on that, but I don't know that I'd definitely spend some time in Colombia because I like it so much if I couldn't go to Medellin, but I wouldn't spend near as much time. That's for sure. I mean, I really like Cartagena and Santa Marta, but those are kind of beach towns. They're right on the Caribbean. And I like those towns for like a week at a time. But as far as just living there, I don't really like spending tons of time there. Cause I'm someone who likes going out to concerts and going out to kind of, you know, where you can get dressed up. Like if you're in an area where at no point in time could you ever wear like a suit and tie and be considered where your attire was appropriate, I'm probably not going to want to spend 6 months there. You know, like I wouldn't want to spend personally 6 months in Costa Rica or Nicaragua or something like that. It's just, I mean, yeah, the beach life is fun for a week or two and surfing and doing all that stuff. But I just don't like wearing board shorts for 6 months straight. it's just not my speed. So your thoughts on Australian economy. Also, will you be able to do a video on it? I don't know if I can do a video on it, but Matt, I'd strongly suggest watching the interviews I've done with my good buddy, Martin North, who really goes into it extensively. I mean, you're like Martin says, you're building an entire economy around houses and holes, which means housing market and mining. That's it. And you're putting more and more and more emphasis on the housing driving the economy every single day of every month. That at some point in time, if that housing market goes, your economy is just done. And I'm not a big fan of putting all your economic eggs in one basket. We've seen that play out poorly in other areas, i.e. Venezuela. And I'm not a big fan of the Australian economy. I'm not a big fan of what they're doing politically. I mean, they're doing yield curve control right now, all the way out to, I think it's their 5-year. They're doing yield control up to their 5-year to keep those short rates down for the mortgages, just because, I mean, you're creating so many economic distortions. And at some point when that thing goes, it's going to get ugly. Do I think the SLR will expire? No. I think the Fed knows everything is in such a precarious position, or the powers that be, the central planners, that they don't want to change anything. Like, no. Just keep doing what we're doing, and let's just get back on our feet here what they perceive to be getting back on their feet from the Cerveza sickness. I don't know if they do anything with the, you know, with those ratios for the banks on, especially not with what's going on or potentially going on with the yield curve. And yeah, I would be surprised if they really did something extreme, if they didn't kind of roll that over, if you will. As far as if they did, would it crash the market? I don't think so. I don't think so, because, I mean, I'd have to think through an argument on how it would. The bank lending is just so not part of the real economy right now. It's not even really a part of money creation that's really been all fiscal. So yeah, I don't think it would. But in all honesty, it's a great question. I haven't thought it through to the extent of doing a whiteboard video on it. And if I haven't thought it through to that extent, that there could be some arguments I'm missing there. Could negative rates end US dollar reserve currency? I don't think so, because, I mean, basically what you're saying, I think what you're getting at, Don, is no one would buy treasuries because they're getting a negative yield. Therefore, there wouldn't be as much dollar demand, and that would kind of trigger this downward cycle. I just don't think so, because I think so much of the dollar dependency, and most people don't really think this through, is a result of dollar denominated debt being created. Because when dollar denominated debt is created, it obviously creates demand for future dollars. Now, how many dollars is a different question, because that has to do with velocity. You see, that's something that people don't think through much at all, is they think that if there's a loan that gets created for $1 million, well, that creates $1 million worth of future dollar demand. Not really, because $1 million loan can be paid off with $100,000. It's just you'd have to have a high rate of velocity. So you see what I'm saying there? It gets a bit, not just a bit, it gets extraordinarily complex. but I think if I'm a corporation and I'm getting paid to borrow dollars because there's a negative interest rate, I don't think that's going to deter me from buying or from borrowing dollars. I think I'm going to borrow more dollars than I otherwise would have, in which case that creates demand. Now, I understand how there's a lot of other factors at play here, but I think that's something that could kind of prop up the dollar from a standpoint of being used as a reserve currency status. Keep in mind, like 60% of all transactions globally are still done in dollars, although that percentage is declining. Also, one thing I'd point out is the dollar right now is at, let's say, 90, 192. And going even back to 2011 or so, it was down at like 70 on the DXY. So it can go down a lot. I mean, it could go down by 30% and it's still on the DXY, and it still doesn't mean that it's in jeopardy of losing its reserve currency status. I really think the only thing that could really do that is something that happens slowly. It doesn't just the country say, oh, we're not using dollars anymore. I think it's more of they just gradually stop using them, and you get to this point where there's a lot of currencies that are being used just for, I don't know that there has to be a reserve currency. That's another thing. People always say, oh my gosh, I'm over an hour. All right, we'll end with this question, but people always say, well, the dollar has to be the global reserve currency because there's nothing there to take its place. I don't know. Do we need a global reserve currency? Like, why? Can't Saudi Arabia sell their oil in rubles to some countries and in yuan to some countries and dollars? And yes, logistically, it gets a little complex. It's a lot smoother of a process if you've got one currency. But I don't know that if we don't have a global reserve currency, just the entire system just comes crashing down, and it's just impossible to have that. I don't know. I think it's just kind of a gradual dollar losing its status, if you will, because other currencies are being used in place of the dollar, and it just happens slowly over time. And the next thing you know, there's just all of these currencies that are being used at the same rate as the dollar. And then maybe it just the percentages just keep changing till we get to a point in 20 years from now where there's a currency that has taken over. And now, even though the dollar is being used for, let's say, 30% of global transactions, maybe there's a currency that in 20 years is being used at 35%. And now all of a sudden, that's the majority of transactions because there's so many currencies that are being used. And there you go. But again, a lot of that has to do with debt. And the infrastructure isn't really there for to use a lot of other currencies for borrowing and doing transactions. And then you have the petrodollar. That's another thing that you got to think through. So, yeah. I think my end answer there is going to be the dollar, losing its reserve currency status. I don't think that happens due to negative interest rates. And if it does happen, I think it happens slowly. And it just happens over the course of 10, 15 years. Okay, guys, that has been an hour. Boy, that went fast. That went really fast. Let's do some shout outs. We got Massa, Arthur and Massa in the house. All right. Some of my old buddies. Fatal 9998, 2 Timothy 3, 1 through 17. Harry Hunter, Elijah Brown, David Sanders, Stevie, Jason Kincaid, Robin Willis, Lucas, Brandon Smith, Quentin Lewis, LMTP, Scott Webster, Jung K. There we go. It skipped on me. DD Crew 1, Matthew Vaccarano, cool last name. Hopefully I'm getting it close on the pronunciation, Matt. Stephen Odlin, Bear R, Moody,
in the house. Chicken Dinner 13, Dickie Dunn, Rigo, David Sanders, All Nighter, Hider, Praddock in the house. ICUT, Jackie Alley, Brendan O'Brien. Guys, I'll do, what will I plug at the end? Oh, yeah, we'll plug this again. Rebel Capitalist, the channel. Check it out. Me doing news stories 2 to 3 times a day. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon. I'll see you on the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.